Okay, I'm Tom Harnish. I'm the Assistant Director of State Relations and Policy Analysis at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. Would you like me to start?
Yeah, I think I'm hearing a little. Are you guys hearing the feedback when I'm talking?
Yes.
Okay. So everybody, please make sure you mute your computers and your phone. If you have a question, we can get you in at that point. But yeah, Tom, if you could go ahead and start with your presentation. Thanks to everybody for introducing yourselves. I think we've got a great group of folks here. Going to be a good bit of presentation. So go ahead, Tom.
Okay, just a second. I just got bounced out of there. Okay, here we go. What I do here at ASCU, if you could just move to the first slide here, a little about...
Your line is now muted. Your line is now unmuted.
I just got bounced out.
Okay.
Sorry about that, everyone. So I'm with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, and we're a national association here in Washington. We represent 400 public colleges and universities. Our membership is the college president, so we work on a variety of state and federal higher education policy issues. I work primarily on state issues, but I also work on federal issues as well. So if you go to the next slide, please. Okay. So our annual ASCU public policy agenda is you can access it at ASCU.org/policy, but we serve a large contingent of low-income, minority, and first-generation students. So our public policy agenda is focused on student access, affordability, and student success. And at the state level, we continue to be concerned about the state disinvestment trend in public higher education. Public higher education is a cost-sharing agreement between a number of different entities, but the states really have pulled back their support for public higher education. And what we're working on right now, and we just released a proposal to have the states states try to get back in the game some more and try to keep higher education from being privatized, which is the path it's on. But we also we support need-based aid for students who attend college, as well as P16 alignment. So we are in support of the Common Core agenda. So if you go to the next slide, these are just some of the topics that we cover here at ASCU. So it's a pretty diverse range. We also add in new topics as they come along. Right now I'm working on a policy piece on the pay it forward, pay it back financing schemes for colleges and universities. Bills have been introduced in 20 states to try to switch the policy that would allow students to attend college for free, but then pay a 3-5% of their salary for like almost 25 years. And so that's like one of the projects that we work on. We also work on some issues in certain states, such as guns on campus. So it's really a diverse range of policy goals. So if you could go on the next slide. So the state policy context here in 2014, we have a political pollers. I'm getting some feedback.
I'm getting some feedback.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can. I can hear you.
We hear you fine.
Okay. So we have a in the state higher education context. So what are people, you know, walking into state capitals? What is the political context for public colleges and universities right now? And what we see really in the states is somewhat similar to Washington in that the sense that there's political polarization, but in many of the states it's still the states have a single-party control. So it's either a red state with a Republican governor and completely Republican legislature, or it's a blue state. And so what this does is it makes the governor particularly powerful. So the governor can implement their agenda with only minimal pushback from the state legislature. Diminished legislative memory. Most of the state legislatures have been in office for 3 years left. Many have been bounced out either in the 2010 election or due to term limits. So term limits have severely been an impediment to legislative memory and policy expertise, especially on complicated issues like higher education. We're having some good news right now on the state budget issues. A number of states have the governors have released their budgets, and there's been increased funding for higher education. Last year there was increased funding, but we're still far, far behind in most instances where we were from the beginning of the recession. So we're still digging out from that, but the signs this year have been pretty positive for investment in higher education. And just the final thing to say is that the 36 of the 50 governors are up for re-election this fall. Some governors are termed out, and so there'll be a race for someone else to be governor. But other governors are running for re-election, so it's going to be a pretty political year in the state. So just turning to the next slide. So AFSCME puts out at the beginning of the year a policy brief called the Top 10 State Policy Issues. And what we do is every day we track what's going on in the states and look for trends, look to see kind of what's on the state policy radar, and then kind of put out a forecast of what we think are the top 10 state policy issues. And so the first one that we saw, and this will be similar to the governor's State of the State address, is that the governors are looking to higher education from all the way from vocational training all to university research as a vehicle to address state economic goals. And you can see that with a number of governors having releasing college completion or college attainment goals. So they want to have 55% of their state residents or 60% of their state residents with some sort of post-high school training or education. The second issue that we saw, and I'll just go through a few of these, is that were negotiated agreements. So, for instance, in I believe it was Iowa, the governor asked, you know, how much would it cost as far as increased state funding for a tuition freeze? And they'd say, you know, 4%. And then they would get 4%, and so you would get a tuition freeze, but you would get increased funding. And so they would work together to try to find a common ground where tuition doesn't have to increase. State allocation of state higher education appropriations. This is a performance-based funding, which is still state lawmakers are still interested in. It's being pushed by a number of national foundations, such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Lumina Foundation. The National Governors Association has been interested in performance-based funding. So this trend started a number of years ago, and now states throughout the country are either implementing or drafting higher education performance-based funding systems. And just to go to look at the number five is vocational and post-secondary vocational and technical post-secondary education. And the State of the State addresses this year, so much attention was paid to by the governors as far as meeting workforce shortages. So working with businesses and providing incentives for students to pursue careers in needed fields. And we could go to the second half of the top 10 state policy issues. A number of those are there. You probably in your state have seen a few of these pop up, especially the guns on campus has been getting a lot of interest on campus as well as in the media. So that's kind of the top 10 state policy issues. And then what we do, we track the state of the state addresses and we find out what's going on in the states and kind of see if we were accurate. And in the state of the state addresses, 41 addresses were 41 addresses discussed were analyzed, of these, most of these addressed higher education. So most of the governors talked about higher education. Not all the governors gave a state of the state address, but pulled out 25 different themes from the governor's state of the state addresses. But the biggest theme, year after year after year, we find is that higher education is discussed in the context of state economic goals. So the governors want higher education to work together to try to get people into the workforce, get people jobs, and help businesses in their state grow. College affordability, of course, continues to be important as we read more stories about student debt. We read more stories about student debt. College affordability continues to be a really important public policy concern. Career and technical education, as I talked about earlier, governors are very interested in policies that will help students both at high school and college, and kind of bringing those together to try to get students on a career pathway and try to get them into the workforce as soon as they can. And finally, greater alignment between K-12 and college and career readiness. So dual enrollment this year, we were kind of shocked to see how much interest it had by the governors in their state of the state address. So continuing to the next slide. So governors brought up in states throughout the country dual enrollment. And what I saw is that dual enrollment was mentioned as kind of an intersection between the completion agenda, so getting students on a pathway to completion, but also affordability, so helping them get some college credits and kind of cut down on the amount of student debt that they would have to take out, and also the skills gap, so dual enrollment with a career and technical education focus. So those were kind of the main themes I saw. And a few of the governors also said that they want students to, when they get their high school diploma, also be receiving a degree in a technical field or a skill, or have a number of college credits under their belt at that time. So go to the next slide. So what we're going to be doing here at AFCU is we will be putting out a report in July, and that will be reviewing the legislative session, and we'll see like all of the states that have pursued dual enrollment, for instance. I see that the governors in Alabama has been particularly interested in dual enrollment. Montana has been looking at their dual enrollment system. Wisconsin Governor Walker has expressed some interest in dual enrollment, and as well as Tennessee. So there's a lot of expansion of existing programs or making new programs and trying to make them better. So that will be included in the state outlook. So that will be sent out in July. Public policy publications that I put out every morning, I send out the policy headlines. So what that is that it's a free service. I send it out about 8:30 every morning, and it says all of the policy-related issues that are happening at the state, as well as some here in Washington at the federal level. Headlines is our weekly publication that we send out that kind of summarizes all the legislative activity that's been written about that week in the state capitals. It also summarizes the reports and gives links to all the reports issued both in the states and by national organizations. And finally, policy briefs. Like I said, I'm working on a policy brief right now on the pay it forward, pay it back systems, and we put those out every few months. So you're welcome to subscribe. Be happy to add you to the list, and be welcome to discussion on dual enrollment. So, is there any questions?
Thanks, Tom. Anybody have any questions? Tom, I'm wondering if you could maybe share with us how you, you know, what can we do as a committee, or even what can NACEP do to capitalize on this energy around dual enrollment? And, I mean, I see the list you gave, and I feel like you're listing all the things that we're working on in my state, and I'm sure others would agree, but, you know, so there's a lot of different things. So what do we do to capitalize on this energy?
I would just keep abreast of what's going on as far as the trend lines are concerned, and have some policy briefs at the ready so, you know, you can walk into a state lawmaker's office and say, you know, this is what the states are doing as far as dual enrollment. These are kind of the best practices, and really have those at the ready so we can get these policies going and learn more about them, and really communicate with us here at AFSCU, here at the other associations, so we know. Because we have kind of a broad portfolio, and I'm certainly not an expert on dual enrollment. I kind of have a working knowledge of it. But if you would put out information like that and best practices, we'd be happy to send that out to all the people in our network, all the college presidents that we have, and really kind of raise the visibility of this issue more so than it is getting right now.
Okay, thank you. That's a great idea. Any other questions? Adam, do we have any, I'm ashamed to ask, but do we have anything right now that that could be provided on dual credit that's pretty updated or recent?
Well, in terms of state policies, we have, you know, the two reports that were presented on our last call, certainly there's a lot of rich information in both the Higher Learning Commission's report as well as the Education Commission on the states. I do think that there's probably ample room for some more topical pieces. ECS put out something specifically on career technical education dual enrollment recently, but I could see a variety of other topical pieces that it might be beneficial for us to get some, as you say, sort of short and to the point and good case examples of what states are doing in particular areas.
Well, maybe that's something we need to just talk about more. And then, Carla, I see Carla's chatting a question, but I wasn't, I just kind of caught the tail end of it. Carla, do you want to type that again? Or maybe I can figure out how to pull it up. Have you had a chance to inspect Ohio's College Credit Plus recommendations? Tom, I don't know if you've had
a chance. Yeah, I haven't had a chance. I saw that. I just haven't had a chance to look at that. I see that there's been, just looking around, there's been a lot of, I think Montana also put out some dual enrollment recommendations recently. So, yeah, I'd welcome to learn more about that and read that, but yeah, I haven't had a chance to check that out yet. It would really be helpful for us to understand also where the states are at, because it seems like states are doing so much in this area so fast right now, it's hard to keep track of where everybody stands.
Okay, I mean, I think for the folks on the webinar, if you wanted to send, if you have something that we could share, wanted to send it to me or send it to myself and Adam, we can make sure that Tom gets it. And of course, his email's right up here as well. So I know in Illinois, we've got a couple of pieces that I would like to share with you, so we'll do that. And then, Adam, maybe we can talk off the webinar about anything else that we might want to do. So any final questions, or are we ready to move into the panel presentation? Well, Tom, thank you. And again, fascinating information. And I feel like you just gave a laundry list of all the initiatives in Illinois. So, you know, obviously, I guess it's good to hear that those things are the hot topics across the country, but Also, you know, exciting to know that there ought to be a lot of folks to network with around the different things that are happening across all those 10 areas, but certainly around dual enrollment. So
yeah.
Thank you for taking the time to do the presentation.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me, and I'd be happy to, like I said, answer any questions offline or discuss any potential collaborative efforts on dual enrollment.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and we'll strategize a bit and get back with you on that.
Okay.
Great. Well, Tom, you are certainly welcome to stick along and catch a snippet of some of the best practices and different types of state funding arrangements for dual and concurrent enrollment. I wanted to just take a minute here to borrow from the Higher Learning Commission's report. Among the things that they did not present on our last webinar was their summary of funding arrangements that they found as they scanned across 50 states. And I think this will be a nice sort of framing point for the state-specific information you're going to hear about shortly. But if you look and see, across the states, actually, a majority of the states do have some sort of direct funding for dual and concurrent enrollment. And Higher Learning Commission used the term dual credit here, so I guess I'll use that for the rest of the slide. Often they were directed at a specific program, and so in a number of states there is funding available, for example, career and technical education, but perhaps not in academic credit areas. And then some have just overall funding. A number of states also have what they call tuition or fee regulations, and I'll give an example of this. Indiana, for example, has a set rate for which dual credit courses that appear on a priority list can be offered at, and so colleges and universities provide those courses at $25 a credit hour or less, and they also have some regulations on offering courses for free to free and reduced price lunch students. And then fewer states have provisions about funding of textbooks. One of the things that I don't think we're going to get to highlight today in terms of the states that we've got on the call today is financial aid. But there are a handful of states, particularly those states that have education funds from lottery revenues, that do provide some scholarship funds or grant funds as a form of financial aid to students for dual credit. Then the last two charts on here really relate to kind of what happens in the funding formulas and how dual credit is treated in that. And so the majority of states do allow high schools to continue to receive their average daily allotment funding based upon average daily attendance, and in some cases that's a partial allotment, but in the majority of states it is full, and slightly less than half provide funding on a full-time equivalency basis for colleges and universities to participate, and I know you're going to be hearing more about this from the specific states that that we've got on today. So I just wanted to put this out there. This is a great reference chart. Education Commission of the States table on funding as well also has a lot of rich data in there, not as visually easy to present on a slide, although if somebody's got some time and wants to summarize it, I think it would be an excellent addition to this as well. With that, I want to turn it over to Lisa Reynolds from the Oregon Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to share what's happening in Oregon with regards to dual credit funding.
Thanks, Adam. And like Brian, I would agree that, you know, of the elements that Tom was presenting, it very much seems as though dual credit is seen as the intersection of the completion agenda and affordability and the skills gap and the way to address all of those. I would mention, too, that in Oregon, we have a very ambitious completion agenda by 2025, what we call our 40-40-20 goal, that hopes to see at least 40% of adults within Oregon having a bachelor's degree or higher, at least 40% having some sort an additional 40% having some sort of associate's degree or post-secondary certificate, and the remaining 20% or fewer as full high school graduates, so 100% high school graduation. So for those reasons, for our 40-40-20 goal, I would say dual credit very much, and we refer to this program as dual credit in Oregon, is very much a hot topic within our state. With regard to funding for us, we do allow high schools to collect their average daily attendance, and we do provide FTE funding to the colleges and universities for the students who are enrolled as dual credit. I think the important thing to note about that, particularly for our colleges, is that the FTE allocation that goes to the institutions doesn't necessarily go toward funding the dual credit programs, but rather into the college's general budget. And only some of the colleges spend significant general fund on managing their dual credit programs. Some are completely supported by fees, and I'll get into fees in just a moment. But just to sort of characterize a little bit better or provide a little bit more nuance around what it means to provide FTE funding doesn't mean that that fund goes directly into administering the dual credit programs or providing for faculty oversight and so on. There is significant variation in Oregon. Oregon is a local control state, so there is a large variation in practices in terms of charging for tuition or fees. And I should mention that while we do collect information on what the tuition is at each of the colleges, none of our dual credit programs are charging full tuition of their students. Primarily, they are charging some degree of fees if they're charging anything. And so just to give you a little bit of highlight of what that variation looks like within the community colleges, six of them don't charge anything for their dual credit programs. Three of them charge a one-time transcription fee that's somewhere between $25 and $35. One college charges an annual fee of $25. And then other institutions charge per credit for their dual credit programs on a scale between $10 and $40, and others charge per course and may or may not also charge a transcription fee. So there is considerable variability, and the universities typically charge fees as well or partial tuition, but we haven't historically collected state-level data on that. They do tend to waive those for at-risk students. And within Oregon, we also have provision for what we call an expanded options program within K-12 to ensure that there are accelerated college credit options, not just limited to dual credit, but to provide opportunities for at-risk students, students on free and reduced price lunch, and so on. We also have an accelerated college credit program grant, which can be applied for by the students' districts to assist students in paying for books, materials, and other costs related to their accelerated college credit program. Sometimes money changes hands between the school districts and colleges. That policy really varies depending on the arrangements that are established in the partnerships between the colleges and the school districts and the particular kind of program that is being negotiated. But we don't have any additional kind of state funding sources for dual credit in Oregon. So one of my motivations in really having interest in what's happening in some of the other states and in this issue more broadly is as we're trying to scale up our offerings of dual credit, getting a real handle on how to ensure the sustainability of those programs and that adequate funding is being provided, particularly for the post-secondary partners that are administering the programs and providing the oversight of those programs, is a crucial issue for us.
Thanks, Lisa. Karen, have you joined us?
I have joined you.
Excellent. So next up, we've got Karen Hynek from the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities System.
Long history with offering rigorous courses, and the reality is that it legislatively, we do have significant statutory language around concurrent enrollment. We do allow our high school districts to keep the student ADM because they're actually the ones who are delivering concurrent enrollment. And we do allow our colleges to count students in the FYE that are part of concurrent enrollment programs. In addition to that, we have a long history of TSEO where it's tuition-free to students. So beginning back in 1985, our statutory language forbids us to actually charge students and their families. However, students have to give up a class typically in the high school if they're taking dual enrollment on the college campus. We also have that post-secondary institutions are able to help choose the, they're able to help choose and select the students that are able to participate in concurrent enrollment, and they can make their own eligibility pieces for that. We also have a $2 million set aside for concurrent enrollment to help reimburse the districts that are participating. There's also statutory language that does not allow colleges to charge more than the cost of offering dual enrollment with concurrent enrollment in their contract. And most of our colleges in the MNSCU system, which I represent, do require a mentor. The language also in the MNSCU system, as well as in the statutory language, requires up to the $2 million that's been set aside to reimburse the districts. And initially, that rate was about $150 per participating student. However, because we've had so much of a growth in concurrent enrollment since the language went into effect, it's down to about $42 per student. In addition to that, in our campuses, the districts do cover the cost of the textbooks as well as the direct instructional cost. And that's pretty much my overview.
Great. Thanks, Karen. One of the features of the reimbursement funding, Karen, maybe you could mention briefly about the connection to quality standards?
Say that one more time.
The connection to accreditation and standards with the reimbursement funding?
Yep. The reimbursement funding does have language in it that requires districts to be participating and partnering with NASEP-accredited institutions or institutions that are in the process of being NASEP accredited or have similar statements of assurance of quality or be part of a rigorous program of study like the Perkins language.
Great, thanks. Okay, I think we'll turn it next over to Eric St. Clair from the Iowa Department of Education.
Thanks. You can go to the next slide if you want. All right, so this slide just provides you with a brief overview of the framework which concurrent enrollment operates in Iowa. So any high school student that's enrolled in college coursework is considered jointly enrolled. And as you can see from the chart on the right, there's three subsections of joint enrollment, tuition courses, PSEO, and contracted courses. And concurrent enrollment is a subsection of the contracted courses. So provided a number of eligibility requirements are met, which you'll see in a minute. The concurrent enrollment courses can generate supplementary weighting in the school foundation formula.
I'm not seeing the slides.
Okay.
Are other people having that problem?
Well, there are. I can see them.
No, I can see them.
Okay. Could you tell us who you were who's having difficulty?
This is Mark Stotler.
Okay, Mark, we'll make sure to send you a copy. Maybe try logging out and connecting back in.
And Eric, if you could speak up just a little bit, we would appreciate it.
Sure. Yep. Sorry about that. So on this slide, you can see the joint enrollment since 2004 to present. It's expanded quite a bit. In 2004, there was 21,000 students involved in joint enrollment, and now it's over 40,000 students. So you can go to the next slide. In response to that growth, the Iowa legislature in 2008 passed the Senior Year Plus program, which consolidated a number of existing programs under one umbrella program. And so those consist of PSEO, Concurrent Enrollment, Advanced Placement, Project Lead the Way, Career, and Regional Academies. So on the next slide, these are the program-specific requirements for concurrent enrollment. There are a number of general senior plus requirements, which I won't discuss here, but then there's also program-specific requirements that apply to students, the course, and the instructor. Next slide. So provided all those requirements on the last slide are met, school districts are eligible to receive supplementary weighting for providing those concurrent enrollment courses. So in Iowa, the school funding is based on the school foundation formula, which distributes state aid to districts on the basis of enrollment. The school district is eligible to receive more funding for certain students enrolled in certain programs. So those two broad categories of weighting are special education weighting and supplementary weighting. The goal of supplementary weighting is to help cover the increased costs and encourage the districts to offer and share those programs and extend services. For concurrent enrollment, supplementary weighting provides districts with funding to pay the community colleges for the delivery of the concurrent enrollment course, and the costs pay part of the cost of the college course, often helping to make up for revenue not collected through the tuition since students are not charged for the course. Concurrent enrollment courses have a weighting of either 0.7 for career and technical education courses or 0.46 for arts and science. So essentially, this means that for the purposes of the school foundation formula, students may be counted for a value greater than 1 for the portion of the day that the student is enrolled in those programs, if that makes sense. I have on the following slide the equation spelled out. So for courses that are designated as either arts and sciences, they're designated as arts and science or CTE by the community college using a methodology that is established by us at the Department of Education. There is no set cost for concurrent enrollment courses. Costs are established by a contractual agreement between the school district and the community college. What is mandated is that even if the course did not generate supplementary weighting, if it was just a contracted course provided between the school district and the community college, maybe the school district is using that course for to meet their minimum accreditation standards, students cannot be charged tuition for any contracted course. The only costs that students may potentially face are for textbooks and some fees. With regards to the textbooks, school districts have to provide the textbooks to concurrently enrolled students in the same way that they provide textbooks to all other students. So they will either be able to require to purchase the textbook, or they could rent the textbook, or the school district could provide the textbook free of charge. So in addition, there are certain fees that may be passed along to the students, such as criminal background checks for some nursing programs or optional exam fees. Other than that, there are no costs that can be passed on to the students. Not all courses are eligible. There are alternative and at-risk school programs that are not eligible for supplementary weighting. Articulated courses, non-credit courses, developmental education courses, and independently designed courses such as private lessons, independent study, etc. And then last, some courses are not eligible for multiple weightings, or all courses, excuse me, are not eligible for multiple program weightings, which means a district cannot claim a single course as both concurrent enrollment and, for example, at-risk supplementary weighting. So you want to go on to the next slide? This is the funding equation spelled out. So you see that you start with the state support per student, which this year I believe is just over $6,000. I'm not sure what it will be after this legislative session. So you start with your state support per student, and you multiply that times the portion of the day the student attends, which is equal to the number of class periods per year divided by the total class periods in a year, and that only includes instructional time. Then you multiply that by the weighting factor, either 0.46 or 0.7, and multiply that by the number of students, and that gives you the supplementary weighting for that course. So you can see the example below. If this course, this fictional course, would generate about $6,000 in additional weighting, which would be about $300 per student. I believe that's it.
Great. Thanks, Eric. Let's continue on to our last state profile before we take questions. Next up is Dana Kelly from the Idaho State Board of Education.
Hi, everyone. I hope you can hear me okay. Idaho is in the Pacific Northwest. We have fortunately, we have large-scale support for what Idaho terms advanced opportunities, of which dual credit, which is what we call, which is what the state calls it. Our schools, I think our institutions mainly call it concurrent enrollment, but for dual credit, it has been long supported and long loved. From this slide that you see up here is the front cover of a collaborative piece on dual credit that is put out collectively by our dual credit coordinators from around the state. And on the front cover, it's very small, so it's hard to see, but dual credit has been permitted and authorized and supported by Idaho statute since 1997. And back in about 2004, our Idaho dual credit coordinators started getting together and organizing to meet collectively at least a couple times face-to-face a year and more by other means throughout the year. And they felt that it was important to do this to work together on best practices and also to assure delivery as broadly as we could throughout the state. And about 2005, some of our institutions started participating with NACEP, and that was very fortuitous for our state because shortly thereafter, in 2006, our state initiated a process which was called at the time High School Redesign, in which we were looking to do a variety of activities and make changes within our state to do what we call strengthen the pipeline in providing stronger matriculation from secondary to post-secondary throughout Idaho. And one of these large initiatives with the High School Redesign was developing policy and structure for what Idaho again calls advanced opportunities. And fortunately, our dual credit coordinators have been meeting enough together collectively and also had been learning quite a bit from NACEP. And as the advanced opportunities policy was initiated and statute was put in place to support dual credit in the state, it is aligned very, very closely with NACEP, and so we're very thankful for that. Could you go to the next slide, Adam? I bring this out. All of us have challenges within our states, and so while I like to think my challenge is bigger than your challenge, it's probably not. Are you?
Yeah.
Anybody have a lot to do? I'll try. Is that better?
Your line is now muted.
Dana, are you still able to talk?
Your line is now unmuted.
Okay, I'm back on.
Maybe just everybody be sure to mute their phone or their computer. Hopefully. Do it. And you might also, if you're on a speakerphone, try picking up the handset.
Does that help? No, it looks like I'm still getting feedback.
Dana, what's your phone number? Let me see if I can mute everyone else.
Are you there?
Nope, we're still here.
Okay.
Still have the echo.
Is the audio on your computer as well?
I turned it off because I was hearing the muting earlier.
Okay, that's fixing that. That fixed it.
Okay, are you there? Okay, I'm still hearing a little feedback, but I'll muddle on, and if it gets too annoying, we'll do this another time. But Idaho is in the Pacific Northwest, but we are in the inland Pacific Northwest. And from this map, while it is small, you can look and see that the central portion going from reaching from Canada down through most of the state is mountainous. And what I wanted to identify by this is that while we are a pretty large geographic state with a relatively small population, but we are also a state in which many parts of the area are inaccessible. The dots on here represent our partners in dual credit, which consist of both public two-year and four-year schools, as well as four-year private schools. And you can see kind of the dots go north and south and then over from the east to the west. And in essence, that area kind of followed by the path of the institutions is the area where our population centers. And so delivering dual credit or any of our advanced opportunities for Idaho is pretty problematic, primarily because of our geography and the rural nature of our state. So Idaho, while very, very much embracing dual credit and wanting to be probably the strongest proponent for that method of delivering advanced opportunities to our secondary students, we realized we weren't going to be able to do that in all areas. So we also permit our high schools to offer AP, International Baccalaureate, dual credit, or tech prep or professional technical options. And our state mandates that every high school must provide at least one of these options. The highest used, of course, is dual credit, but due to some of our rural natures and not having teachers that would meet our institutional requirements to teach at our post-secondary institutions, we also in Idaho permit multiple delivery models. So we provide the high school, taught by the high school instructor model. We also have students that will come to our campuses, and we also use a variety of means of distance delivery, both between high school to high school, as well as between our institution to high schools. And in some very small cases, we'll have post-secondary instructors go to the high schools in order to deliver the dual credit courses. With that comes the funding challenges. Idaho does have charges for it. We do not have direct appropriations that go to support large-scale delivery of dual credit at this point in time. But in doing so, we have as a state looked at providing lower cost options for students, particularly for those courses that are delivered in the high school, taught by high school instructors. The cost for that was one of the first tasks of the dual credit coordinators when they started meeting. And back in 2007, they proposed having a consistent fee for dual credit courses delivered around the state. And so that fee was identified at $65. And there was no real magic on how they picked $65. They had some that were lower and some that were higher, and that's what they could agree upon. So those that were charging higher agreed to come down, those that were charging lower, and they felt that in doing so, they would be able to have a more consistent approach towards dual credit particularly as they worked with the high schools and counselors on informing students and their families for dual credit. In Idaho, because we are pretty far away and from many of our sites, it is frequently that we will have more than one college offering dual credit within a particular high school. So if there's a real ambitious high school that's wanting to offer options, they may have to use more than one of our institutions in order to provide those options for their students. And having a consistent fee was helpful in doing that, and that's one of the areas that they are consistent. So for several years, that $65 fee has been kind of what we've anchored to, and yet it has also been a cause of a lot of concern. We will have many of our colleges, not many, we don't have many, but some of our colleges applied the $65 per credit for any option. So they would allow students to come on campus and only charge the $65 rate, even though our policy indicated that should be charged at the part-time student rate. And so we ended up with some institutions who preferred that model, then saying, we can't have a student sitting next to a full fee-paying student and justify that. Our cost to deliver dual credit is more expensive, et cetera. And so then we would also have other legislators or school partners saying, we want to make it free. We don't understand. You're already getting ADA at the secondary level. You're already getting funds from the state at the post-secondary level. You know, why in the world are you adding this cost on to the students and their families? So we ultimately have some of our institutions and others wanting to look at the cost and try to increase the cost, and our board said, we won't even look at increasing the cost unless you can come back and let us know what is the actual cost for delivering dual credit so that we have a basis for which we anchor any fees or fee increases. So that started a project back in 2012 in which Scott Christie from our office and myself, working with our institutions, both the dual credit coordinators and the business officers, embarked on a project in which we looked to try to pinpoint how we could identify. I'm getting a thing on my ear that says the call is done. Is everyone still on?
I'm on.
We're still here.
Okay. Yeah, I'm here.
It kind of scared me. I got this thing saying the call ended, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm talking to the. Who knows who I'm talking to? All right, sorry about that. So anyway, we attempted to work with our institutions to develop a cost analysis template that we could use to start trying to put our finger on what is the actual cost of delivery for dual credit. Since we do have a variety of models, we had to limit our scope, and so we looked only at the method in which the dual credit instruction was delivered in the high school with high school teachers. The way we initially developed the template was we worked with one of our institutions who was fortunate enough to operate as a self-op situation, and so they had good, solid fiscal resources, reporting resources, so that they could look at all of their expenses and all of their revenues, and it was all within their cost center. And they were very wonderful and invited us in, said, here it is, start pulling it apart and organizing however you can. And so from that, we were able to develop a template which looked at revenues and then divided expenses into both administrative and variable expenses. And then we further went back to that initial institution and said, did we capture it? And they worked with us to kind of tweak it a little bit. And this was a four-year institution that we were working with initially with the knowledge from all of our institutions that we would be doing this collectively. And then to sort of test it, we then worked with a second institution, one of our community colleges. And so using the data from both of those institutions, we were able to modify the template, and then we were able to send it out to each of our institutions and have our dual credit coordinators, along with their budget offices and accounting offices, try to calculate the revenues and expenses so that we could ultimately get down to a figure of what the cost of delivery is. And I've sent a template to Adam, and he will forward that out later. It was kind of hard to put onto a slide. It was really quite small. But in essence, in areas of revenue, most of our revenue, again, comes from student fees at $65 per credit hour. So we would look at those types of things and any other revenues that were there. Expenses were captured in things such as administrative expenses. Some of those would be the staff to run the dual credit program, support to the university for things such as copying, motor pool, variety of things there. We also had to capture our expenses that we had in terms of doing what we call articulation reviews. In other words, the oversight between that the university does of the dual credit program in the high school. And then we had other variable expenses that we also looked at. And these were things such as, did we provide a stipend to either the faculty, the instructor, or the district? Did we provide other support, such as in our case, while our secondary is responsible for textbooks, frequently we couldn't get a program to go if they didn't have some textbook support. So there were a variety of different things that would be in there. And then we then looked between the expenses, the revenue coming in, and the expenses, and kind of came up with a number, and then we averaged those to see if it would work. What we found were that we were only able to capture information on a core cohort of our institutions. We had one institution at the time that was so new, and they were growing their program, but they had not, as an institution, been in existence for very long. And so they were somewhat of an outlier. Their cost of delivery was much higher than the others, but it was also because they didn't have many options as of yet, and so they had a lot of a different kind of expenses in terms of gearing up their program. We also had at least one of our institutions who was shifting from the model of dual credit delivery on their campus to dual credit delivery in the high school. And so we had to separate out those expenses. And there, again, the volume that they were offering in the high school at that time was so low. So when we went back to our board to kind of determine a fee, we kind of pulled those outliers out. So that would be nice if we could have just stopped there. But we didn't, because as we were using this funding model, what we also wanted to see was, do the expenses that they're putting down on these on this template, does it make sense in light of what we're expecting the institution to do to adhere to our board standards or NASIP standards? And so as we went back and analyzed this, again, we had someone from our office who was very number-oriented, and I was looking primarily at policy, but we would shift back and forth so we could kind of bring a fresh perspective to each of those areas. We asked a lot of questions, and we were asked a lot of questions. And then we had our institutions go back with the template, and with those expenses, we asked them to go back to our standards and identify which standard was being addressed by which expense. And it wasn't meant to be just down in stone, but what we wanted to do is, if we were going back to the board and saying, yep, $65 is the number, that's the number you should use, but we saw that it wasn't enough to do some of the necessary oversight to meet our standards, then we would want to request an increase so that we would know what we needed to beef up and do to adhere to our standards. I don't know if that makes sense, but hopefully it does. What we ended up with was a great opportunity, as we were doing this cost product, to kind of work with our institutions and get some good reassurance that they were meeting their standards. It was a good opportunity for us to learn from them to learn from each other, and also to kind of have a model. It's not a perfect model. It does need to be reviewed. We would like to expand it to other areas, but it was quite involved. It did highlight some areas of strength and some areas that our institutions need to work on, but most importantly, it anchored to our state what the cost of delivery at this point in time should be. So we have maintained it now at $65 per credit. This is going on, I think, for the sixth or seventh year that we've had that, and we will continue to look at modifying that, but in doing so, we will always go back and do this. Part of the other questions that we were asked to provide for this group today was, what is our state doing? And we do charge. We do work together collaboratively on that fee, but we also realize that many students in our state are probably the have-nots. We have some pockets of affluence, but in general, Idaho is a state with pretty high poverty, and any cost at all may prohibit a capable student from participating in dual credit. And so as our state applied for their first College Access Challenge grant, we dedicated a significant amount of that and have continued to do so to provide low-income students scholarships to make dual credit affordable. And we have really reaped the benefit of that in that we have really seen our dual credit participation by students grow, and in turn then our high schools are wanting more classes, and then in turn our institutions are working with our high school teachers to provide additional education and training to increase our cadre of teachers eligible to teach dual credit for us. And so it's been a really good thing. We recognize that the CACG funds would not be here forever, but we also knew that our state was already working on some models to help and assist with funding. And it's taken forever, and we're not really sure how it's going to go, but we did just have a Senate Bill 1233 passed this year that will provide all juniors $200 that can be used towards dual credit, and all seniors $400 that can be used for dual credit. And during our last years of our CACG grant, we're going to look to leverage those so that we can maximize the ability for Idahoans to take advantage of dual credit options. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them whenever they tell us to.
Thanks, Dana. We will certainly set out both the template as well as a link to the report that Dana put together. It's got a rich range of information, as she mentioned, not just the different cost structures and of operating the dual credit program, but also the linkage back to standards, so you can understand what are the drivers in terms of faculty oversight and program management. With that, let's open for questions for all four of our panelists. Those of you who are on the line, if you'd like to go ahead and ask a question, go right ahead and do so now. All right, we have one question that has come in a chat window here, and I'll just out loud in case some of you can't see it. It's from David Rossman. His question is, in Iowa, do I understand correctly that the state funding support goes to the school district through rated funding, and that district in turn negotiates the tuition rate with the colleges? Do colleges get to count dual credit students as part of their FTE count?
Yeah, that's correct. The school districts generate the money that they pay the college for the course. Do colleges get to count dual credit students as part of their count? I believe so, but they're not charging students anything. Does that answer your question? I don't know specifically about that segment. I'll look into it more.
Okay, the last part, you're saying that the colleges do get to count the dual credit students as part of their FTE, and they receive some state support for that?
I will have to look into that more specifically. I'm not
one of the things I've seen across the states is that even in those states that have FTE weightings for dual credit, you'll find that that in many states, a very small percentage of a college or university's funds come on FTE basis, that the appropriation formulas are on other factors, and that maybe only 5 to 10% of the funding comes on an FTE basis. Now, in some this is it is a significant percentage, and so that's certainly one thing to look at if you're looking at the state's model. Is even if those dual credit dollars are flowing on for the FTE basis, it would still be a very small percentage of the actual revenue that a college or university gets. And as I think it was Lisa mentioned in Oregon, often those go into a general fund rather than directly funding a dual credit program. There's a question from Jill Kroll in Michigan, which she'd like to pose to each state. What was the crucial factor in getting dual credit options available in your state?
I'll go first.
No one.
This is Eric in Iowa. I would say that, well, dual enrollment or dual credit opportunities have been happening in Iowa in some way since the 1980s, starting with the PSEO program. And then that followed, you know, concurrent enrollment followed that program. I would say there was that slide in my presentation that looked at the rapid growth of concurrent enrollment or joint enrollment in the state between 2000 and 2008, where there was rapid growth in the program. So that kind of prompted the legislature to consolidate those programs in order to provide greater accountability and more consistency across all the programs, lay out clear expectations and whatnot. So I would say probably just the popularity prompted action.
And this is Lisa. I would say for Oregon also, you know, I mean, we do have a long history, particularly from Perkins programs of study, of this kind of work that then evolved from being focused on what we called at that time tech prep to encompass lower division collegiate courses as well. And this really got underway for us in 2005. There was a Senate bill that was passed that emphasized transition experiences for students taking college-level courses and AP courses and trying to already even then in 2005 pay attention to saving the cost of tuition by taking post-secondary courses during high school and ensuring the transferability of dual credit courses and that sort of thing. That really gave rise to our dual credit oversight committee and our dual credit standards and the studies that we've done and so on.
This is Dana, and I think our redesign efforts back in 2006 to 2008 evolved around what we called strengthening the pipeline. Idaho has had a very long history of statewide support for public K-12 education, high graduation rates, and yet very low matriculation rates to college. And so this was one initiative of many in which we really tried to broaden and change the culture of Idaho regarding post-secondary education, and this was a pathway that has really been embraced.
Okay, well, that was helpful. Thank you.
Other questions?
Adam, I think it was Minnesota. The $2 million. Can you go through a little bit again how that's appropriated? Because you had mentioned the connection to quality standards. If you could maybe touch on that, I may be getting some of the details wrong.
Karen, are you still with us? I fear we've lost Karen, so okay.
Karen, can you hear me?
Oh, there we go. Now we hear you, Karen.
Sorry, I'm in my car, so I'm trying to work the hands-free piece, and it's not working the way I wanted it to. In answer to your question on the $2 million, it's a set-aside amount of money for concurrent enrollment to reimburse the districts for the cost of mentorship. The reality is, in our state, the ADM dollars still flow to students, or still flow to the districts for servicing students in the high school with concurrent enrollment classes. At the same point in time, the colleges have a win-win in the sense to utilizing concurrent enrollment, because concurrent enrollment students count the same as any other student in their participation toward the determination of FTE. And in our state, FTE does dictate our enrollment numbers, which our state appropriation is solely based on. So that's part of the motivation for concurrent enrollment with our colleges and universities. At the same point in time, the $2 million was a set-aside amount of money that today, because we've scaled so much in the last decade, the amount that went back to districts initially was about $150 per student to offset the cost of the mentorship contracts with the colleges and universities, that today it's about $40 per student participation that is being refunded to the districts as long as they participate with a partnership that's NACEP certified, in the process of being NACEP accredited, or have similar statements of assurance, or are part of a Perkins rigorous program of study.
Okay, were you a part of the, and you say rigorous program of study, were you a part of that OVA project?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Karen, while we've got to your focus, David Rossman has asked whether in Minnesota private and independent colleges and universities can get FTE funding from the state, or would they also qualify for that that $2 million funding that passes through the high schools?
That's a great question that I don't fully know the answer to. I do know that we do have a number of private universities. St. Mary's University is a fairly large private university here in the state, and they do offer concurrent enrollment, but I do not know whether they are reimbursed with state appropriation or not. So I can ask and find out.
Well, we've got you also. This is Lisa. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about the mentoring that the institutions provide to the high schools. I'm guessing that that is a separate amount that the colleges and universities are charging to the districts for that mentorship?
That's correct, and it does vary by institution. So in the MNSCU system, we run a little bit differently than the University of Minnesota, and I represent the MNSCU system, but our procedure requires a mentor for every concurrent enrollment course that's offered. And within our contracts, there is a provision about the amount that goes back to the college faculty member that they're paid for that type of mentorship. And usually the mentorship is there to assure the norming of the syllabus, its oversight to provide the types of orientation that's needed for the concurrent enrollment instructor. It's to provide additional resources to the concurrent enrollment instructor, professional development, those types of things. And it does differ from institution to institution and can be anywhere from $1,500 per course to $3,000 per course, but that would cover the course, not the section numbers. So in our case, you might offer five sections of freshman English, and you're only charged once for that course versus the number of sections, if that makes sense. That's how our contracts work.
As long as you have the same
mentor and the same concurrent enrollment instructor. If you change the concurrent enrollment instructor, then it would be another $3,000 for the course. In our statutory language, it forbids the colleges from charging more than the actual cost to deliver the course. So it's not a revenue generator. It's a break-even.
So the course is offered at the high school, but you have a post-secondary faculty operating as a mentor.
Correct.
Understand that correctly. So does that, so what standards for qualifications do you hold the high school faculty member to, given that mentor role?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it actually is a point of contention within our state with our districts. The reality is the MNSCU system, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, is a combination of our two-year institutions, our community colleges, our technical colleges, our comprehensive colleges, and our four-year universities, and we have two separate faculty unions that have differing standards for credentialing. Traditionally, when you look at someone who's teaching at the two-year level at a community college, it's a direct instruction model. So because of that, the high school teacher has to meet the same credentials that anyone who would be teaching at the community college that same course would need to meet. In general, it's a master's in field or a master's in education plus 16 graduate credits in field. If it's a technical course, again, it's the terminal degree within the technical field, and it's also recency in industry experience. So in our state, we've really struggled to grow concurrent enrollment in technical areas because oftentimes it's hard to find a high school teacher in CTE that has recency in industry hours. They oftentimes have the degree but not the amount of hours within the last 5 years in industry. So that's a struggle that we're still working through. In the universities, they use a TA model. So they have more of an opportunity to look at a more flexible viewpoint on credentialing than the two-year campuses do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's fascinating, the difference in issues, because in Illinois, we have many more issues on the transfer side, and it's the career and tech ed side that we have greater success because we don't, the issue of recent credentials is not as well spelled out as in your system, and it's the credentials that make it difficult.
Yeah, and in our system, our faculty union's contract is very prescriptive on credentialing, especially on the technical side. So it is not just the terminal degree in field, but it's also the recency and industry experience where we really do struggle. We have very few concurrent enrollment classes that are on the technical side of the house. We're more likely to be having college faculty go out and teach at the high schools if it's a technical area. And we also had new legislation just recently that opened up career and tech ed at our colleges. And I think it's important to understand that in Minnesota, we moved away from vocational high schools in the 1980s. So the majority of CTE training doesn't take place at the high schools. There's been an erosion of CTE at the high schools for the last 30 years. So the equipment simply isn't there. It's at the community and technical colleges. So the model is different. It's not looking to grow concurrent enrollment in CTE as much as it is how do we provide students the access to the equipment and the teachers that tend to be at the technical institutions. So they've now opened up our PSEO to 10th grade students for a CTE with limited requirements around class rank or nationally normed exams. So I think that's something that we're trying to do in our state to spark more opportunities to grow workforce innovation and helping students earn credentialing at the same time that they graduate from high school.
Yeah, fascinating. If you could point me to anything that I could read that would help me understand that system better, it would be great.
Yeah, I'd be happy to send things to Adam, and he can help distribute.
Adam, we have another question that's popped up here.
Sure.
I'll go ahead and just repeat.
Lori
okay, Dwyer, for those states that have standards associated with their funding model, what or who initiated incorporating these into the funding model? You should be able to see that in your chat box, folks.
This is Karen, and when we moved in our state several years ago with a $2 million set aside, we have a pretty strong state organization called MINSEP, the Minnesota Concurrent Enrollment Programs, which is an affiliation of NASEP, and they were very instrumental in testifying the need for the standards that NASEP sets forth. At the same point in time, we have a very strong Perkins Consortium, and they, too, talked about the rigorous programs of study, and that's part of the reason why they're also in the legislation, even though it differs with their requirements to what NASEP requires.
Well, we are approaching the end of our time allotment here, so I guess we might have time for one quick final question if there's one more out there. Otherwise, I want to thank very much our presenters for taking the time to share their experience today and for the rest of you for taking your time to join us today. I hope it was beneficial and informative for you all, and we will post the slides and the audio if you want to reference back to them, and I'll be sending around a number of documents that were referenced here during the conversation today. And look forward to speaking with you again sometime soon. We'll work on getting another one of these on the calendar, and we'll look over that list of topics that were suggested during that initial survey and pick some of the ones that were highly ranked, and look forward to continuing the conversation.
Adam, can I add, maybe sure. We want to ask folks, I know we got one volunteer to help with the convening, to do the steering committee on what when we do our convening. Do you want to mention that to folks?
Sure, yes. We will plan to hold a one-day convening on state policy for concurrent enrollment. As a pre-conference event in Chicago on October 26th. Indeed, we're going to look for a few people to help set the agenda for that and figure out what the day should look like and how it can be most beneficial. So still looking for a couple more volunteers to join us on that.
Adam, this is Dana. I think we'll help.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dana. Nothing like putting people on the spot right on a call.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you for signing up, Dana.
All right, folks, have a good afternoon.
You too, Adam. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.